Hi, everybody, and welcome to our podcast for the medical record run out of Johns Hopkins University's Center for Medical Humanities and Social Medicine. My name is Christy Slobogan.
And I am Antoine Johnson.
And we are so excited to share with you today a mini episode featuring Dr. Graham Mooney, whose recent colloquium paper was titled How Public Health Makes Quote Unquote Behavior Alcohol Programs in Post-World War II Baltimore. So we're keeping it close to home today. And you want to tell the folks who Graham is?
Yes. So Graham Mooney is an associate professor here at Johns Hopkins University in the Department of the History of Medicine. He is also an associate professor of epidemiology, director of graduate studies here at the History of Medicine, and the director of the online program for the History of Medicine. His first book, Intrusive Interventions, Public Health, Domestic Space, and Infectious Disease Surveillance in England, 1840 to 1914, examines the history of public health interventions such as infectious disease notification, institutional and domestic isolation, disinfection, and contact tracing.
Yeah, so we'll be talking quite a bit more about public health in this little episode, but in relation to alcohol and in Baltimore.
Fun stuff. Enjoy the conversation. Thank you again, Graham, for joining us and continuing what has been a fascinating process watching unfold with your book project. For our audience, do you mind summarizing the talk, your key points, you know, the main arguments in the paper that you presented for the colloquium?
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be able to talk even more about the paper than I did at the colloquium. Yeah, so it's about alcohol policies in Baltimore after World War II in the context of public health. Really, one of the things I'm trying to do is to chart what happened in terms of how the city, Baltimore City, how it configured policies for alcohol treatment, but also prevention. And the reason why that's interesting in a way is because public health, yeah, as a structured government activity and as a realm of policy, has always been kind of interested in alcohol, particularly ways in which it made folks vulnerable to other diseases, or it was thought to make people vulnerable to other diseases. But it wasn't really until the second quarter of the 20th century that local health departments, state health departments, began to think of policies specifically for alcohol and alcoholism. So what I'm trying to do here is provide, if you like, a fine-grained study of how policies developed from World War II up to, you know, particularly up to the 1990s in Baltimore. So that's the broad aspects of it. The book is about public health in Baltimore generally after World War II. And I'm looking at different aspects of public health, mainly the environment, public health's involvement in primary care services, and also what for the moment I'm terming harm and harm reduction services. And so alcohol is part of that latter section, which also looks at policies for substance abuse and mental health. And so one of the key things about the book is to try and understand the trajectory of public health generally in the context of broader socio-political developments as well, and thinking particularly through, you know, the racial dynamics of the city, but also the governmental dynamics of the city, particularly through neoliberalism. I'm particularly keen to understand how neoliberalism impacted public health on the ground, because we've got a lot of, you know, there seems to be, to me anyway, lots of studies on neoliberalism at the local level in terms of housing, public sector housing, in terms of education, in terms of parks and recreation. Also lots of discussion about neoliberalization of the carceral complex, the prison industrial complex. But we don't have much in terms of looking at the neoliberalization of public health, other than at a global international level. So I'm interested in how neoliberalism works on the ground, and the way in which we see alcohol policies in Baltimore is really it's a lot of non-governmental agencies who are doing a lot of provision of treatment services, such as halfway houses, private psychiatric clinics, privately developed treatment programs for folks with alcohol issues. And so I'm interested in how public health sort of brings those sorts of services under its umbrella as a thing that government should be interested in, but also how it manages those services at a distance. And so it funnels the monies from federal programs and state programs into a lot of these non-profit services and actually provides a way of sustaining and generating even more non-profit activity in these sectors. One is alcohol, one is substance abuse, and then also later mental health services. And so I think that's a story that hasn't really been told in the kind of detail that I want to tell it. And so hopefully it will be a kind of a contribution to policy in the present as well.
That's great. Thank you, Graham. You know, in talking about the book project as a whole, you've spoken about some of your motivations for why you're doing this project, what's missing out there in the scholarship. But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about what led you to this topic. And I assume part of that is being here in Baltimore.
It is, yes. I came to Baltimore in 2003, and I came to the city not knowing very much about it. And so part of this is purely out of self-interest and wanted to understand the place in which I lived. Part of my own personal background is that I've lived in a number of port cities in the United Kingdom. And so Baltimore was another port city. And so I wanted to see what was the same, what was different and so on. And I also do a lot of teaching in the School of Public Health here at Johns Hopkins. And back when I started thinking about teaching a course on public health in Baltimore, in the 2007, 2008, there weren't really many courses about the city in the School of Public Health. A lot of students, master students, were doing Baltimore-related projects in public health, but they had no real grounding about the kinds of issues that, the deep historical issues and structures that impinge on public health practice in the present and research in the present. So that was another gap that I was kind of filling. So it's really a good example of how your teaching influences your research, because the class that I taught, there were very few books out there that I could draw on for secondary material. In fact, the year I started teaching it, Sam Roberts's book, Infectious Fear on Tuberculosis, came out. And I was like, thank you, Sam Roberts, for giving me something that I can actually hand my students. And also, it gave me a lot to think with and think about. So it definitely influenced the way I think about race and disease and health in the city.
Speaking of Sam, we were thinking if you could mention what scholars you're in conversation with, you're building upon or departing from, because, thinking about alcoholism, I immediately thought about Baron Lerner's book on Skid Road in Washington State. But I'm curious, from your perspective in Baltimore in particular, if you can mention any other folks who you see yourself in conversation with for this book project.
That's a really important question. So yes, definitely Baron Lerner's work on Skid Row. We mentioned Sam Roberts and his work on Baltimore and tuberculosis. He's also, as we know, working on substance abuse. But definitely Sam's work is crucial for me, both for understanding substance abuse policies, but also how to think methodologically about alcoholism policies as well. And then there's a whole load of folks who are working on alcohol and alcoholism that, they're just so numerous to work on, particularly federal policy and the aftermath of prohibition, rather than looking at how some of this stuff plays out at a local level. You can think of it as an almost supply and demand side. The supply side is thinking about prohibition, liquor licensing, and so on. That's controlling the supply. But from my perspective, I'm interested in the demand side for policies to manage folks with alcoholism.
That's great. Thank you so much, Graham. So in the process of putting together this project and the archival work that you've been doing, is there anything, whether that be a specific object or document in the archive or like a larger theme, that surprised you in the process of putting this together?
What surprised me? I think one of the key documents that surprised me the most were those in the post-war immediate period, where the real concern was about how, quote unquote, folks with alcohol problems, the pressure that they were putting on the jail and prison system. And so we can think of alcoholism as becoming a disease in the post-war period as a way of influencing policy. But also there was a lot of push from the judicial system and the law enforcement system around not having alcoholics within that system. They recognised that it was punitive, that this wasn't the appropriate place for folks, and that there needs to be other policies that emerge that, you know, that are more humane. That kind of surprised me. I wasn't fully expecting that. I mean, I know quite a bit about the cycle of, you know, folks experiencing homelessness, folks with problems with alcohol, folks with problems with mental health issues, you know, the kind of circular routes that they take through various forms of carceral space, be that prison, mental health, and so on. I was kind of familiar with that, but I wasn't particularly expecting the big push to be coming from law enforcement.
Man, thank you, Graham. Again, like, I'm honored to share space with you, and I'm looking forward to this project. Before we get out of here, we were curious if you could share with us how this book project relates to problems, debates, etc., in healthcare and public health today. You know, you sort of hinted at it earlier, but we wanted to ask you this question directly.
And I'd also be interested in specifically how it relates to problems in Baltimore today, the historical work that you're doing.
Yeah. Well, I think public health is one of the easier historical topics to argue for present day relevance. I'm very pro public health, critical of public health, particularly from a historical perspective, but I see it as a political project. So I'm on board with that in that sense. But I do worry about how public health in terms of the public being, you know, not the population who is the subject of these policies, but the public who basically funds a lot of these activities through taxation, how they are being distanced from public health governance, particularly through neoliberalizing projects that bring in private business. They privatize responsibility and make it much more of an individual behavioral thing, but also basically giving nonprofits the power to create services. And I think that is a form of distancing from the folks who should decide where the money goes, which is really the people of Baltimore through the ballot box. It's become a thing, you know, that was very obvious during the COVID pandemic when public health authorities reached for private business and nonprofits to manage a lot of COVID response policies and services. That distance then becomes difficult to bridge with people when you're trying to convince them that public health is an important thing, because their influence over how it develops has been disconnected. So there's that. And also, you know, you look at any issue in Baltimore, particularly to do with public health, fundamentally it becomes a question of racial issues in the city, be that, you know, segregation, residential segregation, be that blaming poor black and brown folks for their behaviours, be that in terms of accessibility to services. So when we talk in the present and in the present public, in public health, you know, structural determinants of health, structural racism are so important terms. But I think as historians, it's up to us to add that deep history to where these, you know, structural problems arise, how and why they arise, because we're not going to be able to dismantle them if we don't. And so one of the jobs I see of this book is helping us to understand that. And I think quite often that's best done at a micro level, looking at a city level approach. And you could pick Detroit, you could pick Philly, you could pick lots of other cities, but Baltimore is as good a place, if not better, than any to look at these things.
Thank you, Graham. Okay, I lied. I need to ask one more quick question. I'm sorry. I
know. Oh, you tease.
So my dad is this podcast number one fan, and I'm just thinking, I don't think that he knows what neoliberalism means. I'm curious if you could give us a snapshot definition of neoliberalism for the general audience who may be listening to this show.
That's a good point. Mm-hmm. And so when I talk about neoliberalism, really what I'm meaning is a kind of, for the want of a better word, an ideology or a way of thinking about how to govern. And neoliberalism or neoliberalization is really considered to have its origins, at least its most obvious origins, in, you know, 1970s Reaganite in the US, Thatcherite in Britain, policies that effectively, you know, shrank the state and gave more of a role to private business, or at least marketizing government activities. So effectively it's about shrinking the state and bringing business and marketing practices to how governance is done. Not necessarily with any evidence that it works.
Thank you so much, Graham. That's really helpful. We could talk for much longer about this project. And I'm sure we'll continue to do so here at the department, here in Baltimore. But yeah, we're really looking forward to continuing to see how this project goes. And thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thanks for everything.
Yeah. You're welcome. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak.